And then I'll come and get you, give you a ticket. But no, you
wouldn't be worth it.
That's right.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Given the content associated with the things on our agenda, we're actually going to take them in reverse order so that we preserve the bulk of our time for what I think is going to be a very robust conversation about infrastructure. So I'm going to get right to it and open up a work session on House Bill 2264. Colleagues, you'll remember we had a good hearing about this one related to driver's ed across the state. We have been successful in getting the subsequent referral to Ways and Means rescinded. So that allows us, should we choose to do so, to send it directly to the floor. Representative Vince.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2264 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bence moves House Bill 2264 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the bill? On the motion, I should say. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2264 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Gorsuch, would you carry?
I will carry.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch will carry and close the work session on House Bill 2264 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2107. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2107-1, relating to electronic proof of insurance, permits person to electronically verify proof of motor vehicle insurance, declares emergency effective upon passage. Effect of committee amendment creates new provisions, expands verification systems by which law enforcement can use to confirm proof of insurance to include law enforcement data system.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, you're here. Representative Davis, you have some interest in this. Do you want to go around
to
the other side if you'd like to?
I'd be happy to.
Great. Okay. Do you have just one or you have one? Okay, great. Please, come along.
My name's Kim Thatcher. I'm just jumping in here.
Who do you want?
You started. I think you should go.
Okay. I'm Kim Thatcher from House District 25, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2107. I have an identical bill. I was introducing it on behalf of my constituent here, Dan Hepler, and it's. You know, we all hear this, well, there ought to be a law. And it's like, well, yeah, welcome to the 21st century. Maybe we should have a law on this. And so I'm in full support. And why not allow, you know, electronic means of showing proof of insurance? Apparently, there are some other states doing this now. It is very, very new. It's just starting to bubble up. And so I think it would fit into what we do here in Oregon as being with up with the times here. So I just want to show my support, introduce my constituent, but then I guess maybe Representative Davis will go first. But that's I just want to express my support. Thank you.
Oh, thank
okay.
you.
Well, here you go.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm Dan Hepler.
Okay. And do you want to tell us some of your experience or your reason for being here?
Well, the reason that I'm here is that I'm in support of this bill. Because it is nice to be able to have the electronic proof. That way you don't happen to have the wrong card with you. If you get your new card, take the old one out, you're in trouble. With the cell phone and the electronic proof, you have the current date.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Davis?
Okay. For the record, I'm State Representative John Davis. I want to talk about, in addition to the main bill, amendments which I've introduced. What I'm hoping to achieve here is a belt and suspenders approach to insurance verification. So we're talking first about being able to electronically verify your insurance with your cell phone. Many insurers are now allowing this. I think it's a prudent approach to follow the technology. Other states are now allowing it. The second piece is that many states also allow and utilize a rapid verification system. What this is if you get pulled over and you do not have your insurance certificate, or even if you do, the officer who pulls you over is able to look at their computer in the patrol car, which connects with the state database, and that database is updated weekly or monthly, depending on the state. And that database says, has the insurer informed the state Department of Motor Vehicles that that driver is insured or not? And if the person forgets to carry their proof of insurance, but the database verifies that, you know, actually they do have insurance, the insurer has taken the time to send that information in the DMV, they're not going to get ticketed for that offense. We did some research in terms of how our jurisdictions are doing this. We talked to the troopers, we talked to Washington County, and we talked to Clackamas County. Oregon has implemented a rapid check system, but we are not utilizing it fully. Insurers are required to send in insurance information to the Department of Motor Vehicles as to whether or not you, as the driver, are insured. But that's where the practice then becomes different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. We talk to some officers, and they say, you know, our procedure is we pull someone over, we ask for their insurance, we run the plates, and the database that the state already runs will tell us on our computer in our patrol car whether or not the insurance information that they've presented, or if they don't have their car, the information that comes up on the screen is correct or not. That's where the jurisdictions then differ. It's basically been left to the discretion of officers if they want to let that driver off or not for failure to carry proof of insurance, even if that computer screen and the state database is telling them that they do have insurance. What this amendment would do is would specifically give officers the authority to not ticket a person if they do have proof of insurance via the electronic database system. So we're trying to utilize an existing state resource to the fullest. It doesn't, that's probably about as good an explanation as I'm going to give. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Yeah. Other questions? Representative Benz.
Great to ask this. So what kind of a hit do the budgets take as a result of robbing us, our cities, of this opportunity to raise money?
That's very good. Any League of Cities folks.
It's a good question. I don't think we have an impact statement yet.
Yeah. I'm
sure but I will say, Chair and Vice Chair Benz, I will say that we've asked around, both within the industry and within the law enforcement community. There hasn't been any resistance to this. I have to say we probably should ask the counties and the cities. And I appreciate you bringing that up.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony, and I imagine we will have more conversation with you in the days to come. We have two other people who would like to be heard on the bill. It's Alex Schiebel and Sean Miller.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Alex Schiebel representing American Insurance Association, which represents 300 insured in nationwide insurance. And we are here to support 2107. Just to quickly add to Representative Thatcher's testimony, there are five states that introduced this legislation in 2012. Another 20 states have introduced it, including Oregon, this session. And just yesterday, Arkansas passed it unanimously. So it's really the trend. We urge your support. It's optional to the insurance companies. It's not a mandate. It's optional to the consumers. And, of course, they can carry both. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in support of House Bill 2107 and the Dash 1 amendment that Representative Davis has introduced. It's a good amendment. Obviously, there's benefits to the motorists, law enforcement, and insurers in this particular bill. Benefits to motorists, obviously, you don't have to worry about updating your car, making sure you're carrying the car in the car. Law enforcement, reducing the number of tickets, as well as insurers, where it reduces printing and mailing costs. Any time in the insurance industry when you reduce those costs, those are always reflective in rates, and so it's a good measure. And, you know, as just to add, I think on some of the other states, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Louisiana, Minnesota are just a few that have passed this legislation. I think Oregon should be one of those states on the front lines of this particular issue as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Representative Blackwell.
So I just want to clarify. So if this were to move forward, the requirement for the insurance companies would be electronic also to the state, so there wouldn't be, now if I understand it correctly, insurance companies have to send a document that goes to the state that proves you have it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, they send a document to the consumer.
Right.
You have the piece of card that you stick in your glove box now that is the proof of insurance. So
right.
When the officer pulls you over, and you may have valid insurance, and you may be completely insured, but if you don't have that card, you're going to get a ticket. So now, for instance, I mean, if this were to pass, you can have it on here and actually show the officer.
Right, but there was some comment about the officers now, if they pull up a license and they look and there is some information already in the state data. So I'm trying to understand the state database in relationship to this change.
Good question. I think I'll...
Senator Davis?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Chair.
Sorry.
My understanding from our discussions with the state is that information is required to be provided by insurance companies electronically. So I think
okay.
It's a pretty rapid system. I don't think we're dealing with paper and pen being sent in.
That's already electronic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Okay, and when you're referring to electronically, is it something that would come in on email so you could mm-hmm. get a paper copy of it and keep it in your car?
Mr. Representative Doherty, yes, you can choose to do both under this. And so, the fact that you could have it electronically or paper, that's your option.
Because okay. Some of us have trouble turning on our phones.
we'll make sure you have both.
And in fact, the mere discussion of this bill has prompted me. I keep meaning to do it, but I'm going to try to take a picture of my card even now and just have that before the bill passes. So, Representative Davis.
And just one more comment and question. Thank you, Chair. I think one advantage of this bill with the amendment is that just anecdotally we hear stories, and I know the industry experiences individuals who will get insurance, get their card.
Yeah.
Insurance is typically good for 6 months and then cancel it within the first month so that they have their card. It's amazing that people do that, but it does happen. I shouldn't say a substantial amount of the time. I think this bill and this approach adds some belt and suspenders to the entire system to make sure that people aren't trying to game the system like that.
Understood. Thank you. Sure. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. We will do a little more work on that amendment and likely be back to the bill. So with that, unless there's anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 2107, close the public hearing and open the public hearing on House Bill 2345. Rather than Troy, we'll have Troy read us a summary,
okay.
But as he gets ready to do that,
okay.
I want to make clear that the point of this bill is to start the conversation about infrastructure, and particularly the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. So no one should be too concerned about the details of the bill as it's written currently. I think today's discussion is intended to explore the issue and see what changes and what approach we might want to take with this legislation. So, Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2345 establishes West Coast Critical Infrastructure Exchange Task Force, consisting of 10 members, 2 appointees from the Oregon Senate, 2 appointees from the Oregon House of Representatives, 4 appointees from the Governor, 1 appointee from the Oregon Business Development Department, 1 appointee from the State Treasurer. Directs Task Force to make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly regarding assessing the status of existing infrastructures and to develop and implement critical infrastructure projects, including but not limited to projects involving energy transmission and efficiency, water storage capacity, municipal water systems, and wastewater management. Requires the State Treasurer to provide staff support to the task force. Sunsets task force on June 30th, 2015. Declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. So Representative Hicks has a particular interest in an angle, I think, to get us started on this. And then we're fortunate to have Sarah Clark, who's the president of Partnerships BC, which has done some work on that. So, Ms. Clark, if you want to join us or if you want to wait until Representative Hicks is done, either way, it's up to you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wally Hicks, House District 3, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am here because Oregon's courthouses are in dire need of repair, thanks in part to the, in large part to the representative from Watson Stadium and others who devoted a lot of time, effort, and energy to this issue recently. We have an estimate of Oregon's court of the scale of the decrepitness of Oregon's courthouses to be something on the scale of $700 or $800 million worth of repairs and replacements. replacements that need to be done. These are not merely luxury types of repairs. In fact, many of Oregon's courthouses are endangering the public. Anyone who's recently been to the Multnomah County Courthouse, as an example, will know exactly what I mean. You'll get about halfway through that structure with a structural engineer and want to run for the nearest exit when you find out what's going on with that building. Other courthouses throughout the state are similarly in poor condition. I think it's Union or Sherman County, actually. Sherman County is a former hospital, and one of the clerks reportedly claims to have been born in the courtroom. And so, anyway, the stories can go on and on, but the point is, this concept of performance-based infrastructure contracts is and truly something worth exploring. And as we go forward, my main message to you, aside from the urgency that Oregon's judicial branch needs you to do, and the citizens of Oregon need you to look at this, is that this is not a transfer of an asset. This is not a sale of land or a giving up of property, public property. This is a contract, a methodology for building and making improvements on public property. The type of approach that has been used for quite a long time in Canada with great success does bring the agility and skill of a private entity while keeping the accountability of a public entity in place. And so this is well worth exploring. These are probably larger scale projects. Indeed, the language of the bill references mainly water related projects and certain municipal projects, which is well worth exploring. But in Canada, my understanding is these are mainly the larger scale projects, and they have had a great level of success that I'd urge the committee to listen to very carefully. So remember the courthouses, please, as we go forward, and keep your minds open on this concept, and I would welcome any questions.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Are there any questions? Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. I was born at Kaiser Hospital in North Bend, which is now also a courthouse, so I think there's a precedent here of somehow transitioning birth centers from hospitals to courthouses. Anyway, your point is well taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And there's an odd similarity there in that persons who are being born and persons who have to go to courthouse have no say in whether they can be there.
That's hilarious.
Similar obligations on our part. Anyway, so that's my piece.
And just in support of your testimony, I recently spoke to the presiding judge of Multnomah County, and she went through a long list of dangers and problems at that courthouse, and I've heard that others are in similar straits. So.
It's appalling. Well, Lane County is
yeah.
So probably, yeah, it is in bad shape.
You keep doing this so well, you lead to the next question. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If anyone wants to see the report that we did a few years ago on the condition of courthouses, I think I still have even the hard copy in my office. There's an electronic copy available somewhere. We heard stories about one courthouse, for example, where they literally hand out blankets to people because of the lack of heating. Not just the lack of heat, but the lack of heating at all. Tremendous safety and security considerations that we need to take very seriously. But we're not talking about amenities like the carpet is old and worn. Yeah. It's safety, security, lack of heat. In some cases, if someone needs to appear in court on the second floor, which is where the court is held, because there's no elevator, there are times when you have to find three strong people on a sidewalk or somewhere to try to help take someone to the second floor. It just appalling situations.
Yes, thank you. Yes,
thank you. And you have done a nice job also queuing up for Ms. Clark's presentation from Partnerships BC. So we will excuse you. We know that you snuck away from the Rules Committee. We appreciate that, as well as your patience, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And Ms. Williams, if you want to join too, please.
Representative Hicks covered my presentation.
You get off that easily, Ms. Clark. We want to hear lots of details about your history and the approaches and the projects you've undertaken. We've been hearing a lot about it around here, particularly with Oregon's participation in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. I think a lot of us view Partnerships BC as a real pioneer in that effort, and so we want to learn from you.
Thank you.
So my name is Sarah Clark. I am the President and CEO of Partnerships BC. We have been working with the Governor's Office for a few months discussing how approaches such as the ones used in British Columbia could be utilized in Oregon. So just a little bit of context for people to understand where we've come from and where we fit in within the provincial organization.
Can you pull,
the
microphone?
Oh.
And maybe just if you push the, there you go, exactly.
Got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that working?
Sound okay? Everyone?
Okay.
There you go.
That's better.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We are an agency that's owned by the provincial government. We were established in 2002 to explore alternate types of procurement. There was a large capital program being foreseen at that time. The alternate procurement had been looked at within the province for a few years prior to that, and the conclusion was that they wanted to have an agency that was that would become a center of expertise for exploring, analyzing, and implementing if it looked like it was a viable option. Since that time, we have served the government and public sector agencies within the province and outside of the province, as it happens, through planning and delivery of everything from healthcare to transportation, justice, recently energy projects, and housing. So those projects total about $12.5 billion. And have about $5 billion of private sector capital at risk within those projects. We have our own board, which provides governance of our operations, but our shareholder is the Minister of Finance. Just to give some context around, we've had a lot of discussions that public-private partnership, that or PPP, has a lot of different meanings to different people. And in Canada, in our own province, in British Columbia and in other provinces, it's really performance-based infrastructure, as Representative Hicks referenced. They're long-term contracts that often combine designing and building the project with the long-term maintenance and life cycle responsibility associated with that. We had a lot of hospitals. We're on our 12th health care project, and they're all, the story is the same, right? Built, not maintained, deferred maintenance, and they become obsolete before their design life has been reached. It also affects the services that are given in those buildings. So government retains control of these facilities and as well as the programs within them. So whether it's health care or justice, the health care is provided in the hospitals, the security and programs are provided within the justice system, housing. If there is programs within the social housing, those two would be contained. But the real reason that the real benefits that British Columbia has seen is innovation. Not only are these projects becoming in on time and on budget because of the incentives within those projects and the contract structure, but the innovation that the private sector has brought by having all those components working together instead of separate, which is what happens in traditional procurement. And that's not to say traditional procurement isn't applicable. This is less than 20% of the capital spend within British Columbia. It's just where it works for certain projects, but not for all. But for these larger projects where innovation can be brought in and construction methodology, in looking at improving the building for the programs that are planned to be within it, we've seen incredible innovation in the projects. This all relates to value for money for taxpayer dollar. And I think if there's any questions that come up, I'm happy to.
We'll interrupt when they do.
Okay. So ingredients for a successful program, from the time that this started about over a decade ago, we've had great political and stakeholder support for the program, as well as the support across the participating agencies. There's been policy that has been developed that enabled this type of project to go or contracting method to be used, and every project has improved that policy. And it's a continuing learning experience, and government has modified its approach throughout that time. We have a center of expertise that we like to say works for both sides. We work helping, you know, with the government and building best practices alongside the agencies that we work with, but also we're a place that the market can come and bring their productive comments. we focus on best practices, commercial terms, technical terms, consistency, and as a result, BC has been benefiting a lot from a huge competition on these projects. When we started, we were lucky to have 2 to 3 teams that would come to bid. They weren't sure if the program was going to go ahead. BC wasn't necessarily seen as the most attractive place for various reasons over the history, and BC is now seen as a very stable place for businesses to spend their business development dollars and come and bid on projects. They know the projects are going to be going ahead. They know they're well planned. That's been a very big focus of the government, along with their fiscal focus. So just to give an overview, just to give you, you can see that we've worked, the projects have been applied in health and education, cancer center on the bottom, large acute hospital as well to the left. In transportation and rapid transit, there's up to 8 projects now, ranging from major highway upgrades and the Canada Line, which is at the bottom, that runs from the airport to downtown. The Kicking Horse Canyon structure at the top, which was done 21 months in advance of what the province's estimates were. And that's just by looking at, you know, having a different way of providing a design. The more recent projects include a replacement of a hydroelectric generating facility that's at its end of life, needs seismic upgrade, and with an unplanned outage could cause a lot of damage to the fish population. That's a salmon stream. In the bottom, that's a correctional center that's adjacent to an existing courthouse. So the project includes renovations within that facility, as well as on the left-hand side, there is additional 200 and some units. It's a remand center and provincial correctional facility as well. Those cells were precast in Auburn, Washington. should we break, or I can? I have a few project examples to give some context to what I'm talking about of innovation and efficiencies and savings. I'm happy to go into those or break for question.
Seeing any questions at this point? I have one that might end up being part of what you're going to talk about next. But before you get into the specifics, if you could talk generally about what the criteria are. You said about 20% of the projects are appropriate. Mm-hmm. How do you decide which ones are and which ones aren't?
That's a good question. The province implemented what they call the capital standard, and it requires every project between over $50 million for an alternate procurement to be considered. Mm-hmm. So there's a screen done on the projects, and the majority of the larger projects you can see pretty readily whether they're whether they would be a good candidate for further analysis. So usually larger projects, complex, where innovation can be brought forward, either in, you know, constructability, the type of layout, if it's a hospital, and then whether there's a significant long-term maintenance requirement. So things that don't require a lot of maintenance, like the transmission lines, for example, not necessarily good aptitude for.
So innovation, both in terms of the financing and construction sort of methods, and also the operations about how such a facility might be used?
Not necessarily. The province, they determine the programming requirements. So when we get involved, if it's, for example, replacing or expanding a correctional facility, what's the need? Can it be expanded at an existing site? Should it be a new site? There are renovations in the province, or the sponsoring agency determines that.
Sure.
Then there's a procurement analysis done.
But if you said innovation is one of the keys, and I was just trying to make sure you meant both, or to understand whether you meant innovation only in how it operates or how it's financed, constructed.
Design, constructed, financed, and operations, you know, with respect to program delivery is usually left within the province. But I'll talk, one of my examples is about how the procurement was used to incentivize a better hospital that has more operation and clinical efficiencies in it than what the reference concept design was that the province completed.
That would be great. Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm going to wait for their
projects. Okay, yeah. Very good. Other questions at this point? Don't see. Please go ahead.
The Sea to Sky Highway is a highway that people may be familiar with. It runs from Vancouver to Whistler, and it was one of the pilot projects for sure. It had a design that was almost completed, but the province didn't think they could achieve what they wanted to with the budget. The budget was about $600 million. So as part of the procurement analysis, it was determined that we should proceed with trying a design, build, finance, maintain approach with this highway. And the bidders were incentivized to provide more of the features that province didn't think they could afford. So the baseline was that everybody provided the same design as the province, and the winner was the one who could provide more for that same budget. And as a result, there were more safety features, additional four-laning, divided highway, and other features that the province had listed in priority so the bidders could understand. So that was one of the first benefits that we saw from doing this project. The other things that we saw was the attention to the life cycle. This project is about 60 miles long, and there were a number of bridges on this that were, the specifications only required rehabilitation. But because the contract was 30 years, the bidders looked at it from a point of view of whether does it make sense to rehabilitate these or actually replace them, and most of these bridges were replaced. That was an eye-opener for the province. They realized, well, what were we doing? Just, our plan, we would have rehabbed them and kept them for another 30 years. We also saw a lot of innovation that continued during the design on this this highway. There was a few areas where they could not get the highway to the standard that they wanted to within speed on curves, because of geographical constraints. But as the design progressed, the contractor realized, well, actually, I can actually remove this rock, even though it's a lot of it, and I can use it up and down the highway and save money. So the innovations continued. So there were many illustrations with this one project that convinced the province to move forward on others. The Interior Heart and Surgical Center, this is a more recent accommodations project, and I used this one. It was just closed this summer, and this project had a high emphasis on the bidders being able to improve the clinical and operating efficiency of this facility. Anyone who's involved in healthcare knows that the capital is about this much compared to the operating load of a healthcare facility. The province always carries out a reference concept to be able to price the project. And that reference concept was a four-story building, which didn't provide the adjacencies that the clinicians were looking for from an efficiency point of view. But because of the geotechnical constraints on the project, some very poor soil, they thought they could only go taller and have a smaller footprint. And also that the site would have to be preloaded for a year. What was interesting to see is all three bidders, we always shortlist to three, that were involved in the proposal process, came back with three-story buildings. So that was an improvement right away from what the province wanted to do, or what thought they were able to do. And the winning bidder actually said, I'm not even going to preload. I'm going to excavate this site and balance the weight of this building. And I'm going to be done a year early. So there was about a 20% savings on the capital of this facility, not to mention, we hoped, long-term operating savings. Those are just a few illustrations, and I always say if I had a dollar for every time the project team said it wouldn't be done any differently, I'd be at least $100 more richer, but we have many examples. This is the Portman Bridge that was recently opened. This one was an example. You see the old bridge beside it, and it was originally built as the twinning of the Portman Bridge. And when we went into planning, we thought, why are we calling it the twinning? This was originally going to be a long concession. It wasn't in the end, but let the bidders determine whether renovating and rehabbing that old bridge and keeping it for another 40 years versus building a new one makes economic sense. And two out of the three bidders, including the one that won, came back with a single new structure and demolished that bridge. They said when they looked at it from a life cycle point of view, it was about a wash. But when they looked at the traffic management benefits associated with it, that's what pushed them. So it just shows that when you allow things to be left open for the bidding community to look at, you can get some interesting changes. So just to sum up, our experience over the past 10 years, we've 30 projects, as we've said, has been that we've seen not only the benefit of on time and on budget, but these innovations that we hope will improve the life of those facilities. Not only will they be maintained for a fixed price, but the original design should improve the outcome of the use of those facilities.
Thank you. Representative Betts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go back to your remark about the dollar. That would illustrate, I guess, the reason why this wasn't happening before. So maybe you can express when you were saying to whoever you were speaking to in whatever bureaucracy you were dealing with that it could be done differently, what sort of challenges did you find? Were they built-in structural government situations or private situations, or explain to us what the obstacles were that you were able to overcome to achieve these results.
Are you asking for a preview of what we have to look forward to?
No.
Okay.
Maybe. Well, with anything new, there takes some changes of thought process. So I have to say the Ministry of Transportation was incredibly supportive, and as a team, we were part of their team. Our agency works with the agent, as part of the overall project team. But there was actually expertise that was hired to assist us, definitely in preparing the first contracts, the first performance specifications. That's a tough one for people to change from being very specific to, I want the guide rail to go from here to here, you know, to talking about what the outcomes of what you want the project to be. So instead of specifying the light bulb, you're specifying the light that you want. So that takes a bit of getting used to. And as well, as I said, until people can really see the results on a project, we can talk contextually and talk about innovation, talk about savings, but it was really had to be a few projects happen before people could see the proof of that.
Well, I guess where I'm trying to understand, if we were to utilize this approach here, what sort of challenges we might find in built-in approaches that you found ended up costing more money up there and you were able to replace with a more, we might call it value engineering, we might call it practical engineering, we might call it any number of things at the engineering level. At the planning level, we might call it bringing in a higher level of expertise, or at the bidding level, we might call it something else. But at each one of those levels, there's a series of already existent bureaucracies. I don't know what the right word for it is, that you run into, because this is how we always do it. Or mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of little groups that kind of grow up around those processes that then tend to come here and ask us to protect them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering what changed up in BC that allowed you to proceed and circumvent those homegrown
There was definitely good laws. Political and executive support within the government and within the agencies that did the pilot projects. So working with the agencies and then working with the project members and having people that had done the work before in other jurisdictions come and be able to give examples and to be able to help people through, you know, how do I make a performance spec rather than just telling you what kind of light bulb and why is it, what kind of dangers are there, and sort of letting go of that prescriptiveness. That does take having some outside expertise at times to be able to assist with that if that owner isn't used to doing that type of work.
Please.
Right, so I'm getting out here is that there must have been some driver. Was it the fact that you could say to everybody, we can deliver this at so much less cost? And did they then say, well, it's reached a point where we can't afford it, so thus we have to listen to you. We will let you circumvent these existing policies or whatever we might call them. Is that what's happened in BC?
What was the driver? There were estimates to show that if, you know, we're doing a project in a traditional approach for the second for the sea to sky, or looking at an altered approach, could have potential savings. And every project that is done, from the ones that we started with, the ones we've done now, that estimate is done at the time of the business case. So there was, you know, a potential for money savings that was shown to the participating agencies. And then the results were largely viewed as positive when things like the innovations in the sea to sky were known and the first hospitals that were done, and that spread organically then.
So you mentioned risk.
Yes.
Can you go back to that and explain what you were thinking of as you said shared risk? Was that risk as to financing? Was it risk as to outcome? What was the risk?
This is really a process of finding which participant has the best capacity to take a risk. So when we talk about risk transfer in these type of projects, it's not about giving the private sector partner all the risk. It's about looking at what does the government do well and what does the private sector do well. So that analysis is done before the projects are executed. So if you look at things like environmental permits or expropriating land, things that the government can do much better, they stay with the public sector. And we look at the exposure that the public sector may have in a given type of procurement. So if there's multiple contracts being given out with interface risk between those, that's something the public sector would traditionally hold as their risk. In this case, because the project is grouped as one project, that partner is now taking that interface risk. And those things can be calculated to some degree.
So does your organization then come in and for a fee provide and a proposed approach? Or do you come in and act as project manager and take the thing all the way through?
We work on a cost recovery basis for our organization. We're about 40 people, so we're a consulting model within our own agency and for other within the province and for other governments that we have worked with. And we generally don't do the project management; we do the procurement management. So we help with the business case stage with the analysis that I was talking about between a traditional approach or an alternate approach. And then assist with setting up the competitive selection process as well as the structuring the deal.
Representative Lively?
So maybe you did just answer this. So who in these cases is the project manager then?
Generally, the agency that owns the project provides that project manager.
But the role then of the private, I'm trying to understand this relationship between the private and the public. Since they're obviously risking their money too, so that's part of the negotiation. I mean, it goes back to this risk and that quote, they will be the manager. What role does the other investor have?
It's not much different. It's you'll always have a public sector representative team.
Okay.
They may be smaller, that team, but you'll always have the public sector representative project manager there.
Okay.
And you know, there's stakeholder engagement, there's all those types of things that the public sector has to do, organizing their staff, getting the programs ready, et cetera. So we generally work for that project manager.
Okay. Could you speak a little bit more about, you mentioned in your presentation about how you've noticed that there's increased competition, greater levels of interest. The obvious answer would be, the question is, why is that? The obvious answer is they're getting more confidence about how you're doing it. But is there more to it than that?
I think that was definitely the case at the start. The more, after we had a few projects go well and contracts actually be executed, then that drove interest. And that interest, and then the other provinces began doing it as well, so it made Canada a market. We certainly can't feed a huge market with a province of our size, but Ontario has its own version of Partnerships BC, Quebec does, Alberta has had a number of projects, and that kind of scale made Canada an attractive market.
And that I assume, is also part of the thinking behind the West Coast potential. I know, Karen, you have something to say about that,
and,
too.
You know, all those bidders are sitting just on the border. They're waiting for it to happen in the U.S.,
makes sense. One last question for me. You also talked about how it has, I think I'm summarizing this right, has had an impact on making BC more attractive to business and a stable sort of place for businesses to spend their business development dollars.
Can you talk a bit about that? The government over the past decade has been on fiscal prudence, and BC was able to regain a AAA credit rating in that time. So this type of program and the focus on time and on budget certainly lends into that fiscal approach.
Makes sense. Thank you. I'm surprised we don't have any more questions, but I bet we will as we go forward. Karen, you want to help us sort of understand how this might be relevant to Oregon? Is that your agenda, I hope?
My pleasure, Chair Reed. My name is Karen Williams. I'm a member of Carroll Investments, which is a business in Portland, and am an advisor to the work that the Governor's Office and Treasurer Wheeler have been collaborating to do, which has many components reflected in Executive Order 1217. Among them is finding a way to improve the value of the investments that taxpayers make related to infrastructure, increasing our economic resiliency and stability by having adequate and high-performing infrastructure at the greatest economy that we can with state dollars, the or dollars of other public agencies. Under the leadership of the governor and Treasurer Wheeler, there's a core infrastructure team that's been working through those two offices to examine alternatives and best practices, and to think about how best, Chair Reed, as you mentioned, to position Oregon as a member of a West Coast market to be open for business for people who are interested in helping us find better ways to construct infrastructure for the projects for which the types of practices that Ms. Clark is talking about are appropriate. So from that comes the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, which you'll hear more about as time goes by. One of the components of that is looking at the infrastructure gap that we have in Oregon between what we can afford to do with the traditional design, build, geobond, public works methodology, and what might be obtainable using how we might gain greater value for those dollars and spread the taxpayer dollars further to achieve not only current needs but long-term goals. Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, you were asking some questions about how that value for dollars works, and I certainly invite Sarah to collaborate with me here and correct me if you think it's appropriate. But Metro in 2008 sponsored an infrastructure study in the metropolitan area. I was one of the contributors to the thinking that went into that study, and it identified between what we can afford using traditional expenditure methods and what we need, we had somewhere between a $20 and $40 billion gap just in the Portland metro area between now and year 2035. And that kind of gap encourages all of us as Oregonians to think hard about how can we find a better way to do things? How can we achieve greater value for our dollars and better fill that gap? So one of the issues that creates the gap is deferred, or I will be frank and say it, failure to maintain our infrastructure, and so that we get into a position of having to rebuild it instead of repair it or maintain it. And one of the best practices that is highly appealing about the methodology that Ms. Clark is discussing is that it is a design, build, finance, and maintain methodology that contemplates long-term contracts in which the public owner of the project identifies what the project program capacity and performance outcomes need to be, not only at construction, but what levels of performance for those components need to be there for the design life of the project. Depending on what the infrastructure is, it may be 15 years, maybe 30 years, but provides for an arrangement where the private consortium of development participants bring all of those services to the project in a contract where they also provide some capital at risk, so there is real enforceability in their obligations to deliver projects on time and on budget that meet the performance specs, and then to be maintained at a high quality, high standard of performance over the life of the project. When the governor and the treasurer's office looked at alternatives around the, not only in the North American continent, but also around the world for methods for achieving greater value for infrastructure. What became quite clear was that when the same team is thinking not only about what it takes to build and deliver this project to turn it over, but also thinks about the total occupancy costs over a design life of a project and designs to control those costs and to achieve the highest level of performance for the greatest value for dollars. That's what really, I think, demonstrates the great value of this approach for projects in which it's appropriate. Some projects, as Ms. Clark mentioned, don't have a high maintenance risk. So, They're smaller, straightforward. So these opportunities for innovation and for having a private team accept the risk that the maintenance is going to cost more than the parties anticipated may not be of such great value for some types of projects, but for those that it is, it's of quite significant value. So the governor and the treasurer's office have been working together with Ms. Clark and with some facilitation from me and from others working on this effort to think about how we might bring the skill set to accomplish this kind of infrastructure procurement and development to Oregon and to position Oregon to be open for business and part of a vital market to deliver these services.
You don't need to stop for our benefit. I was just asking Troy if your those slides that we have came from you and whether you want to take us through any of them.
Certainly. Actually, I think they came from Sarah.
Okay.
And there's one that is in your packet that I think illustrates the point that we've been discussing, where the slide title, and I don't know if that's on your...
It's not.
But I think you have it in paper copy.
Yes, yes, we do.
Yes. So the traditional delivery model, Sarah, would you like to explain that?
So this just shows the components, and it goes to your question, Representative Lively, about project management. Mm-hmm. All the components that make up a project and where they traditionally reside, whether it be with public or private. So this would show either it's a design bid build or a design build or construction management, and the remainder stays with the agency. And then on the next page, it shows the type of scope that is contained in a contract that we've been using for the past decade. And the terms of those contracts range from 10 years to 30 years, depending on the type of asset. It's really like having your mortgage payment be susceptible to deductions if your builder doesn't replace your roof when he was supposed to or doesn't shovel the snow on time. So on the Sea to Sky Highway, if there's outages on that highway, their monthly payment is reduced. So their private sector money is at risk until they've completed the project, and the province pays them back for that, as well as for the maintenance in a fixed price for the period of the term. And the penalty can be applied if they're not performing can range depending on the nature of the non-performance. So in case of a transit system, if it's if the trains aren't running, that's a big hit. But if the station isn't as clean as it's supposed to be, that's less of a hit, for example.
Have you changed those terms over the course of your 30, 40 projects? Have you learned things that you're doing differently looking forward?
We look at every project and what makes sense from the life cycle of that project. So with the case of the John Hart Generating Station that I showed the picture of, that's only 15 years. The case of that facility, we looked at it, and it was either going to be 15 or 50, because once the turbines are up and running and proven out to be at the efficiency they should be working at, they run for a long time. In the case of if there was a problem with those, we felt 15 years was enough time to find a problem, correct the problem, and then see that that they were actually working in accordance with the specification. So 15 was the right. But the case of a hospital, we often use 30 because that represents more of the life cycle issues with a hospital and the types of components, windows, roofs, et cetera, that will wear out and need to be maintained.
Something else, if I may?
Yes, please.
That the difference between these models may not be quite so apparent, but in the traditional model, the normal state procurement process is that the state agency and the architects design the project, and then they put the project out for least cost construction bid. And there may be some opportunity for the constructor to work with the architects or engineers in a value engineering or sometimes in a CMGC type model. The procurement method that Partnerships BC uses and that Sarah is talking about really contemplates a fully integrated team approach that you'll hear more about from Troy Dixon, who's going to testify after us. But I think this is a good illustration of why what he's going to explain to you is much easier to do in this kind of procurement than it is in a more traditional procurement.
And the collaboration really starts right through the competitive selection process, where a lot of the it'll take about 5 months for the bidders to put forward their proposals. And in that time, there's a series of meetings during which there's a lot of discussion around the contract documents, the requirements of the owner, and the bidders are able to point out a lot of times where the contract can be improved, where there could be better technical solutions if the performance specifications were modified, and that's really where the collaboration starts and then continues.
Representative Lively?
So if I'm understanding this correctly, so in that model, the financing is strictly private. It isn't a blend of public and private.
That's a very good question.
Okay.
One of the lessons learned, back to Representative Bent's question, is when we originally started, a lot of the projects that have been done like this in other jurisdictions used 100% financing. Mm-hmm. One of the first few projects that we did had federal contribution.
Yeah, that's what I was
saying. We realized we don't need to have 100% financing. Okay. Province has 100, AAA credit rating. So we do an analysis not only on the term, but how much money should be at risk.
Great. Thank you.
And then you can take advantage of both.
Of both. Makes sense.
If I may?
Yes, please.
Part of the research and policy development that's been done in the governor and the treasurer's office is also looking at what solutions for doing this kind of work have worked in other jurisdictions. You heard Ms. Clark describe Partnerships BC as a company that has a single shareholder, which is the Minister of Finance. And there is a report that we're glad to make available to you that was done by the Brookings Institution in Rockefeller that's probably really the clearest statement of the paradigms and the issues. And that identifies the concept that a jurisdiction that establishes a what they call a PPP unit, or public-private partnership unit, that is a specialized center of expertise, is the kind of solution that has demonstrated the greatest commitment, allowed the greatest depth of skill, and so consistency of practices, and that single point of entry for companies and investors who are interested in doing the work. So the model that Sarah is describing is this unit of expertise that provides services to all units of government that are trying to do projects that fit this kind of delivery model.
I think what might make sense at this point, unless you have something we need to know right away, is to ask, there are four other people who want to be heard on it, and we can ask you to stick around. My guess is that that's going to generate a bunch more questions, then we can come back to you, and in particular, ask for your guidance on what Oregon needs to do next. So if that's okay with you, we'll call up those two. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that would be Troy Dixon and John Mullis. And we know we have two more folks after that. We have a slide back coming up.
Go ahead. Good afternoon. I think I have a slide deck coming up also.
We're getting a little help here. Here it comes.
Okay. Started. afternoon. My name is Troy Dixon.
You don't actually need to lean into the microphone. It's very sensitive, so you just leave it right there and talk, and you'll be fine.
Thank you. So I am a vice president of Howard S. Wright Construction in Oregon, and I was the project executive for the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt project in downtown Portland. I am here today to share some of the features and benefits of the innovative integrated project delivery methodology used on the Edith Green project. Many similarities to the discussion that we're following, other than the finance element and possibly the maintain element. Just a brief background, Edith Green Wendell Wyatt, which I'm sure most people are aware, was originally designed. It was built in 1972, and it was designed. There was a federal award to a local architect to do a series of corrective actions to the building back in 2002 through 2006, because the building had definitely outlived its lifespan. There were a number of problems with the building, and the maintenance was getting to the point where you could even see through the building enclosure. So the building got the project got put on the shelf with financial cuts back in 2006, and with the advent of ARRA, the project was revived. And so with ARRA came a number of conditions, and GSA, the General Service Administration, elected to utilize integrated project delivery on the project with the promise of basically doing a complete building modernization and creating an iconic project in lieu of putting a series of Band-Aids onto the building. So really, the benefits to integrated delivery that I think are well documented in the industry now and were very applicable to the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt project. First of all, the schedule, the speed of delivery was a major issue. With ARRA, the project had to be started in October of 2010. Howard S. Wright was awarded the project in January. So we had to go from basically start of design with the architect and the owner as basically a three-member team in 9 months had to be under construction. And maybe even more challenging was the budget. It was an established budget of $125 million for the project. That included a number of things that I'm going to get to here in a moment. But with the federal government required that the money was obligated by the end of March in 2010. That gave us 3 months to define the project, the new project, and maintain all the requirements that were defined within the program requirements for the project. So it clearly could not have been done under traditional methodologies. And then the program, it was really the administration had decided that the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt project would be basically held up nationally for sustainability and energy efficiency, as well as the architecture had to be iconic. So my objective here today is to demonstrate some of the differences between integrated project delivery and traditional delivery, and try to share why those were so beneficial to the GSA and the taxpayer. So a few of these, I'm going to hit a couple of them. A couple of the key principles, the leveraging early contribution of expertise, that is really the foundation of integrated delivery, and that is the willingness to bring in expertise early from industry. And the concept really translates to you bring in the best people through some form of competition, and that includes key subcontractors that are key to the schedule and the performance of the project. And you put safety nets in place to make sure the competition is sound, right? And that might mean that you're pre-negotiating overhead and profit, and then you establish those performance criteria early. Everyone is a co-owner. The way it works, the way it has to work, is that the team members have to be oriented to the project, to be aligned with the objectives, and then integrated to the project to function as one team. If you don't function as one team, it simply breaks apart. So you have to have leadership on each of the prime
participants, the owner, the contractor, and the design team that buy into this idea that we're going to function as one group. And that really translates to complete transparency. So it's a group of professionals that are some of the best in the industry, but they buy into the fact that they have one united goal. So they share everything from budget to design issues collectively. And then what really is changing the industry today and making this work is the availability of technology we have today that we didn't have even 5, 6, 7 years ago. Just to give you an example of that, Howard S. Wright, what we did is we embedded some of our staff into the design team, and the designers are now using three-dimensional BIM models. Mm-hmm. And so they're designing within a computer in three dimensions. So now you can introduce the contracting team into that process, and they can build in constructability, cost efficiencies, and affect the design from day one. You're no longer in this reaction mode after I see the drawings. Well, guess what? We have a budget problem. We got to backtrack. It all happens seamlessly now. And then the one that I'm a big proponent of is this, and Sarah mentioned it, is this idea of this innovative idea that we constantly improve and innovate. In most traditional types of delivery, once you're past a certain point in the design, it's considered fixed. It doesn't change, and everybody kind of digs into that. In this, in integrated delivery, you basically shed that. You don't bring that forward to the project. So the team is constantly working towards improving everything that happens on the project. So just because the specs that were written 6 months ago say this is how we're going to waterproof an element, if technology changes or something improves or somebody has a better idea, everybody buys into that we're going to improve that because that's value to the taxpayer. This slide here is graphically representing the difference between design, bid, build, which we know often referred to as lump sum, CMGC, which is, of course, very popular and very valuable in our industry, and the integrated delivery.
And I think might these just break in here to say that not all of us have the same level of familiarity with the acronyms as you do. So to the extent
I apologize.
Can, that'd
I should
be great.
Know better than that.
That's okay.
The design, bid, build is really kind of the old school idea that the architect designs and the owner come up with the design. The contractors bid it outside of that environment, and then the low number usually gets the project. I think it's well established, not too many people would disagree, that that is far and away the longest duration and sometimes nets the earliest or the least first cost, but most often not the least turnover cost or final cost. And then CMGC is really the next step in collaboration, and that is the ability of the contractor to get awarded early so that they can bring, at least the contractor can bring their ideas forward. And
construction manager,
thank you.
General contractor.
And so the general contractor has the ability to influence, but it still has certain constraints built within that approach. So the integrated delivery approach breaks down all the barriers and creates one team amongst all those experts. And so the design team still has control over the critical design elements, but they're getting educated by the industry.
I guessed at most of what those are, but what is GMP? I see what it looks like.
Guaranteed maximum price.
Thank you.
And that's a great point. Thank you. The under the design build, design bid build delivery method, the lump sum amount is known fairly late in the process. So there's this period of time where you don't know what the project's really going to cost. And under CMGC, you bring that back quite a bit. But under integrated delivery, in the Edith Green example, we committed to a $123 million contract before the drawings were done. So the federal government could obligate the money. And the risk, we talked a little bit about shared risk. The risk on Howard S. Wright was the ability to educate and contribute to bring that project in at $123 million.
So in the integrated delivery model, excuse me, the team's in place even before the conceptual or not? Where does the team actually,
The key team members, I actually have a slide. I'm going to bounce over to it right here. So this is the key team that we started the project with. We were in a competitive mode with GSA for 4 months. We were awarded the project in January. The way they set up the procurement, understanding that they wanted integrated delivery, they allowed us to bring 5 partners, meaning industry partners, subcontractors, with our team, with Howard S. Wright, to the competition. Okay. And given the nature of the project, that it was a full building modernization, we selected the mechanical contractor, the envelope contractor, the electrical, the demo, and the elevator, all because one of our objectives on the project was to achieve one of the most energy efficient high-rises in the world. And we sought out people who could be price competitive and help us meet that goal. Okay. So what this slide is intended to represent is that we started with a budget of $125 million. We actually did come up with the concept in about the first month and a half. And we took that to the marketplace, and it came in at $140 million. And so it was through the integrated delivery process that we basically redefined the project and built in all the efficiencies, and we're going to turn the project over on time and on budget. And that budget's $123 million for the core and shell work. So real quick, one of the key methodologies to do that, and this is a subtle point, but in traditional contracting, a set of drawings are issued to the contracting team. They price it, and then they bring that information back to the owner. In target value design and integrated delivery, it's a paradigm shift. We work together every day. We're basically a collective team, and so we're extracting information and contributing information every single day. So we're doing these micro estimates every day. So when these milestones hit, which are usually about 6 weeks apart, and we're wrapping up an estimate to report to stakeholders, all we're doing is collecting the information that we already know. So we don't have surprises at that point. All those surprises have been resolved within that 6 week period on a daily basis. And technology has been a big part of what allows us to do that. So here's an example. I wanted to share a couple anecdotal examples. In this case, what was originally contemplated is the building needed a new blast-resistant curtain wall system because of the security of the building. And so initially the thought was that the slab edges of the structure had to be modified on-site to handle those blast loads and the new curtain wall technology, and we're going to do that all on site. Very labor intensive, would have been quite a bit of time built into the schedule to do that. What we figured out collectively was that we could prefabricate all of that off site if we could extend the building out 18 inches around the entire perimeter. And so essentially what we achieved is we saved well over $1 million taking this approach. We cut off probably about 2 months out of the schedule. And the real gain to GSA was that we netted 26,000 square foot increase in the building over the 18 stories of the building, and which effectively was like adding another floor to the building. And so there was basically a win-win-win from all three fronts on that particular case. So those are that's an example of what happens in integrated delivery. The second one I wanted to share is in the world of building modernization, the single highest risk is the demolition, not only from a safety risk, but also from a defining what the scope is, discoveries, surprises within the building. And so we looked at it from a completely different view, and we said, why don't we take the demolition contractor and bring them into our team, make them partners with the collective group. And while that took a little bit of time to sort out the issues, it actually netted a very beneficial outcome. We pre-negotiated the profit to that contractor and basically operated with them on a complete open book basis. So we managed their labor with them. We saw everything that was happening, so we affected their productivity. Howard S. Wright and the demo subcontractor actually took the demo design scope away from the architect, which often they don't like to do anyway, but we took that scope away. We parked ourselves in the building for 4 months and designed the entire scope. And what it netted at the end of the day is we had a $6.75 million contract, and we gave back $224,000 of that at the end of the demo due to efficiencies. But the biggest benefit is that we mitigated $790,000 in change orders that we would have gotten under traditional delivery, and that was mostly through discovery of asbestos and lead and things like that. So, again, definitely a preferred approach. And then, real quick here, the program, obviously it was GSA's objective to optimize and achieve the best value for the project. And one of the requirements that came with the project was ISA, the Energy Independence and Security Act, which required that we had 55% reduction in fossil fuel, 30% reduction in energy usage, and 30% solar thermal. So this is what we achieved on the project. A typical high-rise in the United States, we use a term called energy utilization intensity, which is a measurement of energy usage in a building. And a typical high-rise in the United States is measured at an average of 94. Edith Green was between 77 and 83 before we started, and mostly because of Portland's climate. But through integrated delivery and that design process, we're going to turn over a building in 2 months that's going to be between 34 and 36, one of the most energy-efficient high-rises in the world.
I hate to interrupt, but are we nearing the end?
We're here? At the end.
Excellent.
We're there. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
My last point is just that everything we did on the project, because of the way the team was assembled, we approached, we studied life cycle cost analysis, similar to what was mentioned earlier.
Thank you.
And that's it.
That's a terrific story, and I think it will inform our discussion. Mr. Mullis?
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I want to start off by sharing a few thanks. Governor Kitzhaber and office and Treasurer Wheeler's office both reached out to me and our council early on as these West Coast infrastructure discussions began, and that's very much appreciated. I'd also like to thank Ms. Clark for taking the time and effort to come to Oregon and share some of the things that Partnerships BC is doing. It seems like a very interesting and innovative and effective way of trying to address some of the infrastructure challenges that we're facing. There's a couple of reasons that we're very interested in continuing to see this move forward and being part of it. And obviously we all know the very great infrastructure needs that we have and the difficulty that we face in trying to figure out how to finance them. And the second reason is obviously we still have way too many members out of work. And so we are very interested in looking at all these new and innovative ways of trying to fund these projects. As a matter of fact, some of our local pension funds and a number of our international pension funds have started to look at how they can adapt and help fund infrastructure projects. Condos, retail, hotels, some of the stuff that we've, office space, stuff that we've traditionally helped finance in the past is obviously still weak. And so if there's ways that we can change some of the policies within our funds and help fund infrastructure projects in the forward, going forward, we're very much interested in doing that. So the one qualifier I'd like to add is that obviously we would like to see prevailing wage be part of the value that in these new public-private partnerships as they move forward. They're still public projects, they're public entities, and so we would want that to be part of the conversation. But we're pleased to be here and support the concept and would like to be part of it moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for either of these gentlemen? I wondered if you could say just a little more about that, the conversation that's going on amongst the pension funds, and that, for me, that's one of the really attractive and intriguing concepts that some of the private sector dollars can go towards public projects. Exciting for me.
Chair Reed, yes, it is, and I think in some of the private projects that we fund, there's a higher rate of return that can be recognized as opposed to infrastructure projects. That it's my understanding they take longer to achieve a payback rate, and the percentage might be lower. But in my line of thinking, all of our pension funds have balanced portfolios, yeah. Lots of equity, a lesser amount in bonds that, as we all well know, are a very, very small return. So if we can get somewhere in between those two returns with the infrastructure funds, why wouldn't we want to take some of our pension dollars and help fund these projects and get a better rate of return than if we park the money in bonds and have the added feature of putting people back to work?
Thank you. Representative Betts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a very interesting explanation of a federal project where the amount initially is capped. Mm-hmm. And my experience with them hasn't been that way. What instead has happened is it's been look for those change orders and pile on.
Right.
And that's not what I saw here.
No, that's the promise of integrated delivery. Everybody's working together. It's no longer a silo where everybody starts to protect their interests. There's a collective interest. The architect and the contractor and the owner are all sitting in the room together, and we understood exactly what we had to finish the project at. So the building scope and definition was developed such that we would get to the end at that price.
Paul?
And then, so it was, I wrote this down, it's all in the incentive. So that seems to be the magic of this particular project, where the driver, you go through and you identify those drivers, and then you make sure they're written in appropriately into the contract. And you can see them in the different presentations we've heard so far. We need a bullet point of those drivers so that we can then, because they're scattered. But it's extremely interesting, I must say.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, we have two more people to hear from, and then we're coming back for the question of what's next. And they are Christian Steinbrecher and Tracy Rudin, please.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Christian Steinbrecher. I come here as the president of the Oregon section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. We're 2,000 members strong of civil engineers here in the state of Oregon. We have in our membership engineers from contractor organizations, engineers from design organizations, engineers from government, and engineers from private owners as well. I also bring this year 40 years of experience in this civil engineering business. I'm a professional engineer, and I have worked as far east as the East Coast, as far north as Kodiak, and as far south as San Diego. Most of my practice, however, has been here in Oregon. And what I want to talk a little bit about here is, after an extensive two-year effort, the Oregon Society of Civil Engineers produced an infrastructure report card on Oregon's infrastructure. Now, this report card is different than what the national infrastructure produced. We focused strictly on Oregon and what was important to Oregon, Oregonians. We contacted over 120 engineers, public works officials, and industry experts in Oregon, as well as extensively researching the available data that focused on Oregon. We looked at Oregon's infrastructure. We gave Oregon a C-. A nation and its prosperity depend on infrastructure. The cornerstone of a great economy is infrastructure. It moves people, goods, and ideas, and makes possible a state's great accomplishments. But infrastructure does not meet the needs of Oregonians, jeopardizes our future prosperity as well as national security. Oregon needs to reinvest and renew its infrastructure. When there's a catastrophic failure, the result that results in lost lives and property, infrastructure issues make the headlines. The public then realizes the need for a strong and properly maintained infrastructure. Solutions to improve Oregon's infrastructure must take account the diversity that exists in this state in terms of land size, population density, and economic base. One size in Oregon will not fit all. We're the ninth largest state in the country. If Harney County, with a population of 7,705 and an area of 10,228 square miles, were a state, there would be six other states in this country that would be smaller than it. The Western Oregon has 31% of the land mass, but 87% of the population, and economically we're one-tenth the size of California and about a third the size of Washington. So we've got our work cut out for us. But you know, there's a myth in Oregon. And the myth is that the pioneers were rugged individualists. But you know, history tells us that was not the case. They were cooperative people who understood the need to get together to help each other out. One family could not bring in the crops to raise the barns that were necessary to survive. So Oregonians got together and helped this family harvest the crops and that family to raise the barns. That's the attitude we need in Oregon for the next century, that Oregonians must come together as a group and pitch in and rebuild the next generation infrastructure. The infrastructure that we rely on today was constructed in time frame from 1945 to 1985. During that time, this country was the most wealthy country on the globe. There was no Chinese economy. There was no Asian economy. The European economy had been smashed by the war. As a result, we were the wealthiest country on the face of the earth. With this wealth, we financed this great infrastructure. While I say we're still the greatest country on the world, there's a lot of competition. The money that was available to build that infrastructure is not available today. In short, we need new ideas and new thinking, not just slavishly rebuilding the old. Oregon must construct a new infrastructure that will propel Oregon into the forefront of the 21st century. But what I have distributed to you in front of you is a copy of the Oregon infrastructure. Again, I want to emphasize this is very different from the national report card that was done. This was done by Oregon engineers for Oregonians, and I suggest you look at it, and we're obviously available to provide additional information on that report card if you think it's necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both for the report, which I think we will find very useful, and for summarizing your written testimony. We will read it. We appreciate it.
Gratitude for that.
Yes.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Benz, and Cornerstone members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Renton, and I'm here today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, representing Oregon's 242 cities. And we thank you today for the opportunity to testify on this bill, I think, but more importantly, for having this conversation to look at ways to collaborate and find innovative approaches to address our growing infrastructure needs across the state. I understand that Craig Honeyman with LOC was before your committee on Monday to talk to you about Connect Oregon, but also I think to voice that we'll hope that you take a very thoughtful approach in terms of looking at the investments that we make in infrastructure. We are obviously supportive of transportation infrastructure projects and improvements, but there are a lot of projects that are across the state that that are critical at this point and critical to our communities. And we'd like to make sure that those projects are also part of that discussion going forward. This past fall, LOC did a survey of its members to look at some of the critical infrastructure needs across the state. And based on information that we gathered from 80 cities that responded, representing 67% of the incorporated population, we were able to estimate over $2 billion needed to fund city infrastructure projects. The results of that survey showed a majority of projects identified, 79% of them were wastewater, water, transportation projects. Well, transportation projects were, I think, the financial majority, over just over $1 billion in infrastructure needed that we identified. Water and wastewater projects were the greatest infrastructure need in terms of the total number of projects. So those are often the projects that are in our smaller communities who are really, really in need of some of the financing, and also the medium-sized communities as well who have, I think, difficulty in accessing capital they need. Stormwater projects were another $88 million, and then utilities, facilities, recreation, and there were some miscellaneous projects in there as well that accounted for the remaining $262 million. Nearly half of the water projects that were identified were for waterline replacement and repairs, and many of those projects were simply to maintain the city's ability to meet their current needs. Other projects that we identified involved water updating water meters, security measures to protect the water supply, and then just general updating of dilapidated infrastructure to save in their long-term cost, and also look at ways to increase their water conservation. The city of Port Orford, for example, needed reported a need of $9.5 million to replace leaking water lines, and they estimate that they're losing nearly half of their treated water supply. With a population of 1,135, the per capita cost for that project would be $8,370. In terms of transportation needs, they ranged from street and road improvements to active transportation projects. And we are able, and I'm more than happy to do so, to bring a breakdown of the projects that we looked at. We can do that by House District, and I'd be more than happy to bring those by to share with each of you to take a look at what projects we've identified in your communities on a citywide basis. We thank you for the opportunity to testify today and, again, for the conversation, and are interested to see where this goes in support of going forward.
Thank you. I think we would find that information helpful. Are there questions for either of these two? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm scanning through this, but I was trying to listen to you, too. I may have missed it. Is there anything in here about funding projects for telecommunications or communications? In particular, I'm very concerned about not having adequate it not having the adequate infrastructure for first responders, but it's also critical for economic development for not only rural areas, but even certain neighborhoods and cities that are left behind. So apart from economic development and first responders, which has to do with public safety, we've also got needs for telemedicine or telehealth and education. And some of these could be public infrastructure where the private sector leaves us behind. Is that included in here at all?
Representative Nansen, before he answers that, I don't think that's necessarily distinct from economic development. I think it all relates.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, in terms of distribution of our survey results, I'm not sure as to the telecom. We did utilities generally, so I'm not sure where they fit into that. But I would be happy to do a general breakdown sheet just so you could see the projects that were identified and see where that does fit into that.
That would be great.
Yeah. Mr. Steinbrecher, any thoughts on the telecom question?
Well, obviously, it's a significant part of electrical and wired backbone, and we share the concern that it's certainly lacking in certain parts of the state.
Yeah, a quick follow-up. Okay. It's not only wires and cables and conduits. In some cases, it's paying for microwave and other sorts of microwave and cell equipment. Mm-hmm. It's paying for towers and appropriate footings and electrical power backup supplies so that you don't lose communications.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now perhaps the show we've all been waiting for. What next? What should Oregon do next?
Chair Reed and the committee, thank you again for your time this afternoon and for your thoughtful interest in this discussion.
And I must ask you once more to identify for yourself for the record, since there's been such a gap since we've been hearing from you.
Hi, thank you. Excuse me, Chair Reed. I'm Karen Williams. I'd like to acknowledge that in your packet is some information, an Oregon Live article from yesterday about the Multnomah County Courthouse, and I won't take your time to go into great detail about that since it's in your packet and you're able to read it, but I do want to acknowledge that when Representative Benz discussed what are the obstacles to encouraging people to try something new, and I to acknowledge the leadership from Multnomah County, Commissioner Shiprock, Commissioner Kafori, their colleagues, to be willing to explore new ideas and look for solutions to the courthouse.
And Commissioner Kafori is in the room, by the way. We did ask her if she wanted to testify. She said no, so we're not ignoring her.
Thank you. The things that we need to do in order to bring this skill set to Oregon are the optimum solution is to create a center of expertise in Oregon similar to the center of expertise that has been so successful in Sarah's organization in British Columbia, and to work with governmental institutions and agencies about implementing best practices and to identify appropriate opportunities to use this expertise in the state. The state's participation in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange to establish that critical mass of a marketplace that Ms. Clark so well explained is also an important piece. And so, of course, is appropriate opportunities for stakeholder and governance feedback as those processes are implemented in the form of the task force kind of approach that Chair Reed's draft bill suggests. Those components, some various authorities and capacities that we need to implement these and to make sure that we have a smooth process that fits both the needs of the public sector for achieving greater value for money, strong competition, and good opportunities for well-informed and enforceable risk transfer when it's appropriate, allows the private sector to come to Oregon and bring their skills for innovation and to bring some supportive capital.
Ms. Clark, if you get to start over and design from the beginning, how would you do it? In essence, if we were to ask you to come to Oregon, what should we be doing?
That is what we've been working on with the governor's office and Karen. So we've been able to provide the benefits of what kind of startup, how would you start, how would you fund, where you can draw on that expertise that's already exists in other jurisdictions, and be able to look at the projects from the beginning with the right kind of screen. British Columbia picked a few projects to start with that weren't appropriate, or when they were implemented, the approach was somewhat flawed. So hopefully by being able to draw on the expertise across North America and from us, that will be avoided.
We hope to learn from you, for sure. Mm-hmm.
I have to say that BC has not only benefited just from the expertise that, and the innovation that these teams have brought, but being able to do more, the size of the capital program has been very large over the past decade, so be able to draw on the additional resources these teams brought allowed a larger capital program as well.
If you could pick two or three things that you know now that you wish you'd known when you started, does anything come immediately to mind?
Only three?
That I'd say out loud.
Yeah. You can tell us later, too.
This is recorded.
For the twos of people who are listening on the internet, too.
That's right. I think it's having the right mix of expertise in, and if you choose to proceed with a PPP unit, having that right mix of expertise. We had a lot of focus on the financing side. Now we have a much better blend of people that understand financing, but people that are engineers, that have understand construction, understand design, and the integration of those pieces. So I'd say our organization has a different balance of talent now. That would be one.
That's an important one. Thank you. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very interesting concept. It looks to me, though, as the thing I had missed until the second part of your presentation was the fact that you spread the financial piece out over such a long period of time, and that brings so much more value, so much more money into the discussion.
Yes.
Makes it a much more exciting thing and a much more interesting thing. It only works for institutions, and so you have an institution on one side and a private entity on the other, and you're explaining how you make sure you keep them in play by virtue of offset opportunities. But at the end of the day, it's about allocating that risk piece looking forward 30, 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And that I see how you've been going to each of these pieces. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to further discussion of the concept.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Nothing else? Okay, well, this is your chance, committee. We're gonna try to, at least I'm going to try to craft some amendments that put us in a place to explore going forward with it. So if you have thoughts or questions or ideas, now's a good time. It's not, you can tell me offline as well, but here we have the experts. Mm-hmm. Last chance.
Chair Reed, if I please, may please anticipate a question. Mr. Mullis offered a comment wanting to assure that the kinds of community benefits that come from infrastructure investment, he mentioned prevailing wage, these projects are owned by the public and public funds are used, so they are public works projects. And the kinds of community benefits requirements that apply to public works projects apply to this methodology. Again, it's not a transfer of the asset. It's a contract for services over time.
That's right. So things like, I think it's also important to point out that a lot of these projects, it takes a number of procurement methods to finish it, to look at. So if you look at the Interior Heart and Surgical Center that I put up, one portion of it is done through design, build, finance, maintain. There's also a renovation portion of it that was done through construction management. There's also another building that was done as a design build. So, you know, it's not only a larger program with how you procure your infrastructure, but even within a project it can be varied.
Modular.
Yeah.
Representative Lively?
So I find this a fascinating concept, and I appreciate that we're pursuing the conversation. The concern I have, given the list, the range of projects and that, and the needs that we know are out there, that we soon put some definition to what projects might fit, because I'm always concerned about expectations. We said about we're going to move from here to there quick and all these things get done.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I know, I think I heard you talk about that's important, and we've got the expertise of some have done it. So to me, that really needs to be part of this conversation. So we don't overset expectations of what we might be able to accomplish by doing this, given the range of needs we have in the state at all levels.
Absolutely. So maybe I could take from your comment a question: how would you prioritize? Yeah. You talked in your criteria about over 50 million, whether there's opportunities for innovation and the need for maintenance. Did you find, or can you advise us if there are particular sectors that are more appropriate, or maybe there are other ways of prioritizing and focusing that I'm not thinking of?
Well, there's two steps to any infrastructure program. It's what are your priorities as a state or broader with the other jurisdictions, and then within those priorities, taking a look at the projects that might be a fit for this type of procurement. As you can see from the presentation I gave, we've been able to apply it from everything through roads, corrections, housing, energy. So there is a broad range of applicability. We're working with the territory of Nunavut right now on an airport redevelopment. So larger projects with a good amount of design creativity required, as well as risk on the execution. Those are the types of projects that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I think we've exhausted the questions for the moment, but I expect we will be in touch as we try to construct what might be our next steps. Thank you very much for being part of the conversation. I appreciate it.
For having Chair Reed, members of the Commission, thank you very much again for your time and your attentiveness.
Thank you. That, unless there's anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 2245, close the public hearing. And Representative Bentz, you have a motion before we go?
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend rules and allow Representative Nathanson, Representative Parrish, Representative Cameron, Representative McEwen to vote on House Bill 2264.
Thank you. Representative Bentz has asked unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that Representative Nathanson, Representative Parrish, Representative Cameron, Representative McEwen be allowed to vote on House Bill 2264. Is there any objection to that motion? I don't see any. 2264, as you see from your agenda, is the bill that we heard previously around driver's ed. The motion was to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, the subsequent referral to Ways and Means having been rescinded. So, Representative McEwen, how do you vote?
Aye.
McEwen votes aye. Very quietly. Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
And Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Unless there's anything else for the good of the order, we will close the committee. Thank you.